bottom line here is that being labeled the problem puts you in a very deep hole, and digging yourself out can be tough. Most people don't wake up each morning thinking, "Now what could I do to wreck my career today?" No sane person wants to become the problem, yet many people rush headlong down the path to political suicide. Some are victims of their own chronic self-destructive habits. Others simply make bad choices about how to act in difficult situations. There are four common causes of career destruction. 1. Poorly controlled emotions. 2. A victim mentality. 3. Self-centered goals. And 4. Foolish reactions to change. The hazards of uncontrolled emotion. Most business offices are fairly calm, orderly, rational places, at least on the surface. Beneath that placid facade, however, lies a hotbed of emotion. All workers have the same feelings on the job that they experience in every other aspect of their lives. They've just learned not to show them, which is actually a darned good thing. If people demonstrated their true feelings all the time, little would be accomplished and few colleagues would be speaking to each other. One guaranteed way to become the problem is to let your emotions run amok on the job. Brandon worked for a retail store owner who was slow to take action and often tried to skirt difficult issues. As Brandon's frustration with this behavior grew, he began storming into the owner's office and yelling till he became red in the face. The owner, who had previously considered making Brandon a partner, decided that perhaps that wasn't such a good plan after all. Brandon never knew about the opportunity that he had unwittingly thrown away. Lois, a department manager, was completely intimidated by her employees. If they criticized her decisions or complained about her management style, Lois meekly listened without responding. When problems arose with her employees' work, she was so fearful of their reaction that she never mentioned the issues to them. Eventually, her boss concluded that Lois wasn't management material and replaced her with a stronger person. The two emotions that most frequently lead people down the road to ruin are anger and anxiety. Everyone feels angry or anxious at work from time to time. That's perfectly normal. But problems arise if persistent negative feelings create a pattern of destructive behavior that interferes with your results or relationships. Your emotions are completely private unless your behavior telegraphs the message to everyone around you. Anger is the most serious problem, because too much hostility causes people to walk the other way when they see you coming. Angry people intimidate others and are simply not pleasant to be around. Dangerous behavior patterns that arise from poorly controlled anger include complaining, rebellion, and confrontation. Complaining. Tom is a salesperson who constantly gripes to his colleagues about his boss, gripes to his boss about his colleagues, and gripes to upper management about what's wrong with the company. Rebellion. Carol is a social worker who resents authority. She disagrees with her manager's decisions, refuses to obey policies that she doesn't like, and encourages her clients to bend the rules. Confrontation. Ray is a manager who frequently yells and curses at his staff, berating them for making mistakes and ridiculing any new ideas they suggest. He has been known to literally bring people to tears in meetings. When these anger-based behaviors become too pervasive, the offenders begin to be viewed as more of a hindrance than a help. And at that point, they are just one short step from the exit. At the other extreme, overly anxious behavior sends the message that you are weak, worried, and dependent. Unless being a doormat is part of your job description, insecurity is not usually a career asset. Anxious people self-destruct because they either fail to address difficult issues or appear to be totally dispensable. Timidity, neediness, and hiding are some of the troublesome behavior patterns in this category. Timidity. Bob is an experienced engineer who is afraid to speak up in department meetings for fear that he may say something stupid. As a result, he sits quietly during discussions and seldom expresses an opinion. When faced with any disagreement, he capitulates quickly just to keep the peace. Neediness. Because Anne constantly worries that her work may not be good enough, she needs frequent reassurance that everything is okay. At each step of a project, she checks with her boss to be sure she's on the right track. She can be brought to tears by any negative feedback or critical comments. Hiding. Dennis is a computer programmer who is uncomfortable around people. He prefers to work alone in his cubicle. If he sees an executive coming down the hall, he may duck into the restroom to avoid a conversation. Some of his colleagues don't know Dennis's name, and many have no idea what he does. Having angry or anxious feelings is part of being human, but allowing them to control your behavior is politically disastrous. Succumbing to your emotions is like drinking too much. In the short run, an occasional binge may do little harm and make you feel better, but chronic abuse will inevitably lead to long-term problems. While we're on this topic, a word should be said about one more emotion, lust. Some unknown wag once coined this sensible saying, "Don't look for your honey where you get your money." Politically astute folks direct their desires, fantasies, and romantic overtures away from work colleagues. Most workplace romances eventually die out, leaving a trail of political debris in their wake. If you think you've found the one true love of your life at the office, then you may want to take the chance, but weigh the risks carefully before you proceed. Regardless of whether the emotional issue is anger, anxiety, or lust, those who lack self-control will inevitably enter the dimwit category sooner or later. And since dimwits are destined to become the problem, that is a risky place to be. Seeing yourself as the victim. People talk to themselves all the time. As you go through the day, your mind automatically produces a running internal commentary about the events you experience and the people you encounter. You may sit quietly and smile while your boss critiques your project proposal, but an entirely different conversation is going on in your head. This guy is really an idiot. He obviously doesn't understand the project. In fact, he never takes the time to really understand anything. I don't know why I stay in this job anyway. I think I'll polish up my resume. Is this hypocritical? Heck no. Masking our internal reactions is an important skill in both office politics and everyday life. No one wants to know what everyone else is thinking. But here's the problem. You have to be careful about what you tell yourself, because people tend to believe their own messages. If you fall into the habit of thinking, "This guy is an idiot," every time your boss speaks, you will automatically begin looking for supportive evidence. "My boss is an idiot" will soon become an entrenched belief and eventually creep into your communication patterns. Before too long, your boss will start to get the message that you think he's not too bright, and that realization will change the way that he talks to himself about you, possibly leading to undesirable consequences. You must always be mindful of what psychologists call self-talk, because what you say to yourself shapes your attitudes and your behavior. Have you ever found thoughts like these going through your mind? "No one appreciates all the work I do around here. They just don't want to pay me what I'm worth. I always get passed over for the really good assignments." Occasionally, throwing yourself a small pity party is a harmless indulgence. But if you have such thoughts on a daily basis, watch out. You may be creating a victim identity, one of the most politically destructive forms of self-talk. For some, Mild paranoia just seems to be a natural state of mind. Put them in any job and they will find an enemy somewhere. Other victims start out as self-sacrificing martyrs who go to great lengths to please others, then become resentful when their efforts fail to be fully appreciated. Sometimes a victim mentality is triggered by some unfair event that suddenly casts the world in a different light. All subsequent actions and interactions are then carefully screened for signs of unfair treatment. And as always, when evidence is sought, it becomes easy to find. The aggrieved party soon accumulates a truckload of proof that her conclusion was correct. She is indeed a victim. Since every victim must have at least one persecutor, anyone assuming a victim identity will automatically identify certain managers or co-workers as adversaries, then begin to treat them accordingly. Thus begins a vicious cycle that can lead to political suicide. Dorothy, a supervisor in a government agency, applied for promotion to section head, but the job was given to another candidate. As she pondered this rejection, Dorothy was puzzled. She had the required experience for the position. She always received excellent appraisals. Managers frequently praised her work. Her unit was performing above expectations. So why didn't she get the job? She finally concluded that her manager had probably failed to support her for the promotion. Considering this possibility, Dorothy recalled the times that her boss had left her out of meetings or rejected her ideas. Yes, she decided, he clearly must not have a very high opinion of me. Otherwise, I surely would have gotten that job. So Dorothy began to cast herself as the victim, with her boss in the role of adversary. As her resentment grew, Dorothy stopped asking her manager for advice or dropping by his office for friendly chats. Then she began to notice that he no longer sought her opinion and spent less time with her than with the other supervisors. She gradually developed the habit of communicating with him primarily through email. When her next performance appraisal included some negative comments, Dorothy filed a grievance with Human Resources. After these charges were deemed to be invalid, she began to gripe about her unfair treatment to anyone who would listen. When she applied for another promotion and was again rejected, she wrote a scathing letter to the department head complaining about her boss. At this point, sadly, Dorothy crossed the tipping point and became the problem. She may keep her job, but she will never, ever be promoted. This may or may not be fair, but it's a fact. Dorothy was not torpedoed by her boss, but by her own negative self-talk. Suppose that instead of assuming a victim identity, Dorothy had put aside her thoughts of unfairness, met with her boss, and said, "I was very disappointed about not getting the promotion to section head. I'd really like to know what I could do to improve my chances next time." Perhaps she could have saved her career. So be careful about what you say to yourself. If poor little me is a recurrent theme in your internal or external conversations, you need to change your negative self-talk before you develop a victim mentality. What if you really are a victim, though? If you are facing true discrimination because of your race or age or some other illegal consideration, that gets a bit tougher because you have some choices to make. First, be sure that your assessment is correct. Sometimes illegal treatment is easy to spot. I once knew an African-American gentleman who found a noose hanging in his work locker. Not much question about that situation. But consider this one. A young black woman who shared a secretary with her white boss complained that the secretary always did the boss's work first. She attributed this situation to racial prejudice. But odds are that the secretary, knowing who would determine her next raise, had made a political choice, not a racial one. Fortunately, the young woman decided to talk the situation over with her HR manager, who was able to help her view it differently. A person's true motives can be difficult to determine. If, however, you believe that you are indeed experiencing illegal discrimination, you have reached a fork in the road. Do you quietly try to overcome these prejudicial attitudes, or do you file an official complaint? The gentleman who found the noose certainly needed to let someone know, but the best approach is less clear if you fail to receive a promotion or get a negative performance review. In a perfect world, you could make your protest, have the problem investigated, and go on to a successful and prejudice-free career. But I have to give you some unwelcome news. In the unjust and unreasonable real world, once you file an official grievance, you have crossed over an invisible line and become an adversary to management. No one will tell you this. No one will begin to treat you differently, at least if they have any sense. Yet I can guarantee that managers will be having hushed conversations about you and viewing you as a potential problem. Let me be quite clear. I am not suggesting that people should tolerate illegal treatment. I applaud those who are brave enough to take a stand against prejudice. When you consider going public with such a charge, though, you need to be aware of the political ramifications of that decision. Often the best course of action is to consult a trusted friend or colleague to get another perspective and discuss possible strategies. If you have a helpful HR department, you may find that they can provide good advice. Should you conclude that getting a fair shake is impossible, however, your best option may be to find a more enlightened place to work. When it's all about you. Selfishness is another contributor to political downfall. All sociopaths have this problem. They just want what they want when they want it, with no regard for the common good. Like basketball players who always take the shot and never pass off to their teammates. Sociopathic people can be found at all levels. One of my clients has an administrative assistant who feels that the job is beneath her. She will happily tackle any task that she views as professional, but routinely ignores mundane activities like copying, filing, and answering the phone. Why doesn't she simply change jobs? I have no idea. But I don't predict a long future for her in this one. At the other end of the organizational ladder, you find self-centered CEOs like Dave. Here are a few examples of the behavior that qualifies Dave for this category. After being summoned to corporate headquarters for a meeting with Dave, seven executives spend the entire day sitting and waiting in the lobby while he does other things. One Halloween night, Dave wants to talk to a manager about a matter that could easily wait until the next day. Dave tracks him down, finds him out trick-or-treating with his young daughter, and orders him to take her home and come into the office immediately. Dave's company is located in a southern city that only sees significant snow about once every 5 years. After one of these rare snowstorms hits, Dave orders the facilities manager to purchase a Jeep with a snowplow attachment so that no one will ever again miss one of his meetings because of weather. I could go on, but you get the idea. Let me ask you to predict Dave's behavior in this situation. It's Saturday evening. Dave wants to talk to an important customer about a large order. Dave calls the customer at home and is told by his wife that they are in the middle of their daughter's 16th birthday party. So, what does Dave do? That's right. He insists that the reluctant customer come to the phone and discuss the order. The following week, the customer calls a board member to complain. Now that you've gotten to know Dave, are you surprised that he was eventually fired? Even a CEO can become the problem. Not all self-centered people are sociopaths, however. Some are martyrs, acting in the interest of what they believe to be a higher cause. And dedication to that cause takes precedence over all other considerations. Single-minded advocacy is great if you're a lobbyist, but In most business situations, overzealousness is politically imprudent. Being so narrowly focused, these advocates lack the sense of balance required for political success. After making a change to the petty cash policy, the new executive director of a nonprofit group found herself faced with a crusading finance manager. Although the executive director was doing nothing illegal or immoral, her new petty cash policy so infuriated the finance manager that he refused to sign off on purchases and sent a letter of complaint to the board. Although we finally backed off, the finance manager almost sacrificed his job for the sake of petty differences over petty cash. Many professional people struggle with the balance between professional standards and organizational realities. Nurses have to fit many patients into a crowded schedule. Engineers have limited time to create a workable product design. Marketers can't afford the ideal advertising campaign. Lawyers have to defend their bosses' risky decisions. For professionals, the ability to successfully walk this tightrope is a critical ingredient of political intelligence. Winners are able to view a situation from various points of view, but sociopaths and cause-driven martyrs see everything through the lens of their own desires, finding it difficult to shift their thinking to a different perspective. Extreme selfishness and misguided advocacy often lead to political self-destruction, because no organization can succeed if its members act only in their own self-interest. Foolish reactions to change. For some previously successful people, their political decline and fall is triggered by a particularly stressful change. Suddenly, their boss, job, or organization is no longer compatible with their belief about how work should be done. Such a change can occur in many ways. Debbie, a creative, free-spirited graphic designer, left her job with a small ad agency to join the marketing department of a large corporation. Jack, a successful retail salesperson, was asked to take a newly created management position when increased business led to an expansion of the sales staff. Anita, a manager in a government agency, found herself reporting to a new department head after an election brought a different political party to power. Rick, a software engineer, discovered that job expectations had changed when his small technology company was acquired by a larger competitor. Sometimes we choose a change, as Debbie and Jack did when they accepted new positions. Other changes are thrust upon us by resignations, mergers, or reorganizations. But regardless of the cause, people who lack political intelligence may quickly decide that the new state of affairs is wrong. Then they reinforce this feeling with negative self-talk. This company is totally disorganized. That woman just doesn't understand how we do things around here. These managers don't want to take time to do things the right way. Nobody cares about the employees anymore. Because they're wrong automatically implies I'm right. This politically suicidal reaction often marks the beginning of an adversarial relationship, which, left unchecked, can easily escalate into a power struggle. We all know how those turn out. The person with the least leverage loses. Life, as we have already established, is not fair. When circumstances change, things sometimes just don't go your way. This is not usually a matter of right versus wrong, however, but simply a case of something being different. Your new boss will probably have different habits and expectations than your old boss. That doesn't mean she's wrong. When you change jobs, your new employer will probably have different policies and procedures. That doesn't mean they're wrong. If your business is acquired by another company, the culture will probably be somewhat different. That doesn't make it wrong. Unless their actions are illegal or unethical, New people are not bad or evil or mistaken. They're just not what you are accustomed to. So you have three options. You can either 1, adapt to the new way, 2, leave for greener pastures, or 3, become a pain in the ass and eventually be deemed the problem. The choice is yours. The four people just mentioned made choices that illustrate how differently these situations can turn out. Debbie got into a visible and vocal power struggle with her new boss, making no secret of her belief that the cold and bureaucratic corporate environment stifled creativity and rewarded mediocre work. After 9 months, Debbie's manager got tired of arguing and let her go. Fighting the organizational culture is a pointless battle unless you're the CEO, and sometimes even then. You're not going to change it. Jack quickly became frustrated in his new management job. He and the store owner, who had previously had a pleasant working relationship, began to get into shouting matches over policies and procedures. Fortunately, Jack finally recognized that the problem was not the owner, but his own adjustment to a management role, and they were able to work out their differences. Anita immediately disliked her new boss, whom she viewed as a political hack with little concern for the agency's mission. She expressed her unhappiness by aggressively debating him in staff meetings and ignoring projects that he viewed as high priority. He, in turn, began to override her decisions. Realizing that she would probably never be happy in this new environment, Anita chose to leave for another opportunity. Rick, despite his initial dismay, eventually found that his job became more interesting after the acquisition because being part of a larger company provided a wider variety of technical challenges. He continued to work there quite happily. Of the four, Debbie was the only one who opted for political self-destruction. The others made wiser decisions. Warning signs of political trouble. Many political suicides are so caught up in their own concerns or delusions that when the axe falls, they are totally shocked. Others sense that they are in political danger, but haven't the foggiest idea how to fix the situation. For the clueless group, I will list the warning signs of political trouble in just a moment, by order of severity. If you spot any of these signals, you have a problem that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed quickly. Level 1. Something is not quite right. You have been experiencing a growing uneasiness with frequent angry thoughts about unfairness. Sometimes people feel like a victim because they are actually about to become one. You find yourself alone a lot. No one stops by your desk unless they have a specific purpose. You don't get invited to lunch, weddings, baby showers, golf outings, baseball nights, and so on. You seem to have become a social outcast. Your boss ignores you, fails to notify you of meetings, neglects to give you information, or makes pointed remarks indicating that you are requiring too much time and attention. Your boss has a serious talk with you about some aspect of your performance or your personality. If your manager tends to be a little wimpy, this talk may sound more like a chat than a reprimand. Consider your manager's style. Anything out of the ordinary counts as a warning. A personal coach is hired to help you. The bad news is that you are seen as having some issues that need to be addressed. The good news is that someone is still willing to invest in your future success. Executives seldom spend money on people they consider hopeless. Level 2. The future looks questionable. An important assignment that would logically be yours is given to someone else. If that someone else has designs on your job or is a rival for your next promotion, this is a troubling development. You are turned down for promotions more than once, The first time, they may have just found a better applicant. But more than that, you're starting to see a pattern. And it's not good. After acquiring a new boss, your leverage seems to be slipping away. You are not consulted as frequently, given as much information, or included in as many meetings as before. If you don't take some action, you are probably headed for that serious talk. Someone from Human Resources initiates the serious talk. This is an indication that management people have been thinking unkindly about you for some time. You may already be considered the problem. Level 3. A sudden career change may lie ahead. Following a reorganization, you find that you have suffered a reduction in staff, title, responsibilities, or reporting level. Or you've been physically shuffled off to the hinterlands. You were probably given some lame excuse for this change. If believing it makes you feel better, go ahead. But recognize that any kind of reduction is a bad sign. Your boss's boss gets into the act, reinforcing a serious talk that you have already had with someone else. This is not just a warning signal. It's a huge flashing neon sign that says you're about to become roadkill on the corporate highway. Rumors of layoffs are going around and people are starting to avoid you or look at you sadly. If these are human resources people, start working on your resume. Unless you're prone to paranoid delusions, these warning signs clearly indicate that something undesirable is going on. To start addressing the issue, you need to determine whether the trouble originates with you or with your environment. Here's the catch-22. The difficulty may be due, in part, to your inability to see the situation clearly. And if you can't see things clearly, it's hard to accurately determine the cause of the problem. Social psychologists describe a common distortion in human thinking called attribution error, which is shorthand for, it's a heck of a lot easier to blame somebody else. A simple example should easily demonstrate our propensity for attribution errors. Suppose you get a promotion or a big raise. Why did you receive this reward? Because of your superior abilities and performance? Of course. But suppose you get turned down for the promotion. Why did that happen? Probably because the interview process wasn't fair, or because the person who got it has been sucking up for years, or because management doesn't understand what's really needed in that job. Or something, anything, other than your own possible shortcomings. These self-serving attributions bolster our egos. When something good happens to us, we credit this fortunate outcome to some positive personal characteristic. But when bad things happen, we look outside ourselves for the cause. If you feel that you have become a political target, self-serving attributions can seem like your best friend because they're so comforting. All this pain and suffering is certainly not your fault. But if you really are contributing to your own downfall, such mental thumb-sucking just keeps you from correcting your destructive behaviors, habits, or attitudes. They will eventually come back to haunt you in the future. To avoid attribution errors, you need to strive for objectivity and look for patterns. Say, for example, that you have decided your boss is an unreasonable jerk. Do others share your opinion? Is she an unreasonable jerk with everyone or just with you? And what about you? Have you felt that many of your managers were unreasonable or just this one? If your boss has difficulties with several staff members, then the problem may very well lie with her. But if you have a history of dissatisfaction with bosses, then you may need to look in the mirror. If neither one of you seems to have a problematic pattern, the difficulty may lie in the combination of your individual work styles. Some personality types just don't mesh very well. When political warning signals start to flash, Examine the patterns in the situation. First, take a good look at what's going on around you. If everyone is working till midnight, keeping a CYA file, or worried about recording devices in the conference room, then you're in a toxic workplace. Over time, remaining in a sick environment will either completely undermine your self-confidence or warp you so thoroughly that you will be unfit for normal employment. Forget political strategy and exit as quickly as possible. On the other hand, if your colleagues are happily and productively engaged while you're fuming with rage, then you need to take a closer look at yourself. Review your work history, relationships, and reactions to authority, and look for any common themes. Have you been laid off or fired more than once? Have you been repeatedly turned down for promotions or important assignments? Have you frequently thought you were misunderstood or being treated unfairly? Have you often felt angry toward colleagues or found them annoying? When talking to managers, do you become argumentative or defensive? Or do managers tend to scare you? If you are a manager, do you often become angry or annoyed with employees? Have people complained about your management style? Such honest self-scrutiny is not easy, because our brains seem to automatically dredge up all the possible reasons to blame someone else. Recognizing the destructive patterns in your own behavior is the single most important step in averting political suicide. Once you've identified them, you need to immediately begin corrective action. Political plastic surgery. Forestalling career annihilation may not be easy, but it is possible. If you sense that you have become the problem, then you need a political makeover. That is, your image must be quickly and drastically restructured. Consider the plight of Randall, a manager on the brink of being demoted. The high turnover rate in Randall's district office had attracted the attention of his boss, who was becoming extremely concerned. Based on conversations and observations, she concluded that Randall was the cause of this turnover problem. She was right. Randall closely monitored his employees, obsessed about irrelevant details, got involved in the smallest decisions, and offered criticism much more frequently than praise. He was a classic micromanager whose behavior created serious morale problems. To save himself, Randall had to change. But altering ingrained habits is not nearly as simple as people think. The acronym AMISH sums up the 5 steps required to accomplish any personal behavior change: awareness, motivation, identification, substitution, and habit replacement. Even though this process has nothing to do with religious communities in Pennsylvania, perhaps the label will help you remember the steps. Awareness. If you don't know that a problem exists, how can you change? Without feedback to the contrary, most of us believe that we are doing just fine. Many managers drop subtle hints about their concerns, so you need to be alert. Seems like a lot of your salespeople have left for other jobs this year, Randall's boss might say. A politically obtuse Randall would reply, "Yeah, the company just doesn't pay these people enough. You need to look into that." But a politically intelligent Randall, recognizing this comment as a tiny little warning sign, would say, "I've been concerned about that, too. Do you think that our district office is different from the others somehow?" When you sense political trouble, you must find out what people are thinking, even if it's painful. Unfortunately, some bosses practice psychic management. They think and think and think about an employee problem, but never share their thoughts with the offending party, thereby allowing the poor soul to become the problem without ever being told. If your manager never comments on your job performance, soliciting feedback occasionally is a good idea. Motivation. The fact that someone else has issues with your behavior doesn't necessarily mean that you agree. If you don't think you have a problem, you certainly won't be motivated to change anything. Randall never saw himself as a micromanager. From his point of view, he was thorough and careful and concerned about quality. Can you see an attribution error developing here? But Randall will never resurrect himself politically if he maintains this denial. When someone indicates that your behavior is a problem, don't automatically reject that possibility. Instead, try to understand how your actions may be affecting other people. Then perhaps you will be motivated to try some new approaches. Identification. Even if Randall comes to accept that he is indeed a micromanager, he still must identify exactly which behaviors need to change. His micromanagement must therefore be defined in terms of specific actions. Which documents should he stop reviewing? What decisions can he delegate? Which details should he just let go? If your problem behavior has been described in broad, fuzzy terms like bad attitude or poor communication or lack of initiative, you need to get more specifics. Then you can decide what you need to do differently. Substitution. Stopping one behavior automatically implies that you will replace it with another. If you stop speeding, you will start driving more slowly. If you stop yelling, you will start speaking more softly. In fact, any behavior change has a greater chance of success when you define it in positive terms instead of negative ones. Saying, "I have to stop getting angry," doesn't tell you what to do instead. But saying, "When I feel angry in meetings, I'm going to take deep breaths and speak calmly," will give you a positive goal. If you want to eliminate a troublesome behavior, you have to decide what helpful behavior to substitute. When Randall feels the urge to scrutinize the draft of a sales brochure with a magnifying glass, what will he do instead? Perhaps he could decide to compliment the designer on all the positive features and only red pencil major concerns. Or he might decide to delegate brochure review to a lower level manager. Always remember that you are capable of making conscious decisions about your behavior. To rehabilitate yourself politically, you must quickly learn to make wiser choices. Habit replacement. A successful political makeover means that new habits have been developed. You have permanently adopted more effective ways of acting and interacting. But old habits don't vanish overnight, so expect a few relapses. No doubt Randall will occasionally become too involved in small decisions or overzealous in editing a document. If he persists in his efforts to act differently, however, his new habits will eventually begin to operate on automatic pilot. When you are trying to recast your image, remember that others will not immediately notice the change in your behavior. If you're waiting for the applause, it may seem awfully quiet for a while. Even if Randall completely alters his management style tomorrow, people won't detect the change immediately. Once they do, they still won't believe that it's going to stick until evidence accumulates over time. So when you are trying to change, be patient. Don't expect instant acclaim for the new you. But, you may ask, what if I don't need a makeover? What if I'm really not a problem and other people just take things the wrong way? Well, then you need to learn to do those things differently. Because if you're not a problem, but people think you are, the political effect is unfortunately the same. One of my coaching clients, Tracy, was told by his boss that he had a negative attitude and was resistant to change. This completely puzzled Tracy, who insisted that he truly loved his job and had willingly implemented every change his boss proposed. Upon closer examination of his communication style, however, the source of this misperception became clear. Tracy has a real gift for seeing the flaws, risks, and hazards in any idea or proposal, which is a good talent to have. But Tracy exercised this ability a bit too quickly in conversations with his boss. Every time his manager proposed a new idea, Tracy immediately pointed out the possible problems. Tracy felt that he was being helpful, but his boss understandably interpreted these criticisms as a negative attitude and resistance to change. To avoid political trouble, Tracy needed to change this communication pattern, even though he was doing nothing wrong. So he decided to develop a new habit, looking for and mentioning the positive aspects of an idea before describing the potential pitfalls. Problem solved. Regardless of whether political reconstruction requires major surgery or only involves a minor adjustment, we tend to resist it. Listening to criticism, admitting flaws, and changing habits isn't anyone's idea of fun. But the result of ignoring obvious warning signs is almost always political suicide. Personal politics. Are you a candidate for political suicide? Assessing your situation. Think honestly about your situation at work and answer these questions. Do you frequently feel angry or anxious at work? If so, is your anger or anxiety obvious to other people? Do you feel that you have been treated very unfairly at work? Do you mentally review this unfair treatment on a regular basis? Do you frequently talk about your unfair treatment with people at work? Are you having recurrent lustful fantasies about someone at work? Are you involved in a romantic or sexual relationship at work? Do you focus exclusively on your own goals with little thought for others? Would co-workers describe you as difficult to work with? Have you felt resentful about a recent change at work? Has this resentment caused you to exhibit annoying or disruptive behavior? Has a manager or HR person indicated that you need to make some changes? If you have more than a couple of yes or maybe answers, then you could be on the verge of political problems, or you may already have them. Moving from assessment to action. In any area where you said yes or maybe, you need to start adjusting your thoughts, attitudes, and actions. The fact that others may be behaving badly or treating you poorly is completely irrelevant. You need to clarify your goals, focus on the future, and concentrate on things that are within your control. Start by deciding if your current job is right for you. If not, what is your first step toward leaving? If so, what can you do to improve the situation? Do you need political plastic surgery? Assessing your situation. If you have become your own greatest obstacle to success, then you need to start your political makeover. Take a good look at your own behavior. What is causing others to conclude that you are a problem? What behaviors do you need to stop? What new behaviors do you need to adopt? Awareness. What am I doing that is creating a problem? Motivation. Why is it important for me to change? Identification. What are the specific harmful behaviors that I need to stop? Substitution. If I stop this behavior, what helpful behavior will I put in its place? Habits. How will I know when my new behavior has become a habit? Moving from assessment to action. Now that you have defined your desired behavior, Identify the situations in which you need to use it. Anticipate the people or events that are most likely to trigger your old, unproductive actions. Mentally rehearse how you will handle those difficult situations. Visualize success. Determine whether you need to have any discussions to start repairing perceptions. Do you need to tell anyone about your intention to change? If people from management or HR have had a serious talk with you, then you should definitely follow up with them, especially if you were initially unreceptive to their feedback. The purpose of these conversations is to declare your desire to change and describe what you plan to do differently. You must not get defensive, argue, complain, or blame. If you don't have this much self-control, then don't have the discussion. After a while, request some feedback to see how things are going. Follow-up meetings with your boss, colleagues, HR, or other relevant people will not only give you a progress assessment, but also send the message that you are motivated, open to communication, and trying to do things differently. Chapter 7. Power, power, who has the power? To play the political game, you have to understand power. Who has it? How to get it? How to use it. Yet talking openly about power is completely prohibited. To come right out and say, I wish I had more power, or how much power do you have, or I enjoy having power over you, would be much too honest. But because power permeates the atmosphere of every organization, winners must be able to accurately determine how that power is distributed. An Army colonel, describing his recent transition into the corporate world, said, "You know, life is much simpler when the uniform tells you exactly how much power someone has. When everyone's wearing a business suit, things take a little longer to figure out." How very true. Appearances are often deceiving. Imagine that you have just started work with a new company. On your first day, you meet many people, including Steve and Rose. Steve, the vice president of global business strategy, is wearing an expensive suit and has an impressive office in the executive suite with his own personal assistant stationed outside his door. During your brief conversation, he describes his international travels and mentions his recent golf game with the CEO. Rose, an employee relations specialist, dresses unassumingly, works in a cubicle, and does not appear to have an assistant. She warmly welcomes you to the company, asking several questions about your background and your new job. When you inquire about her role, she smiles and says, "Oh, I just handle all the little projects that no one else wants." Rating their relative power on a 1 to 10 scale, you give an 8 to Steve and a 3 to Rose. Over the next few weeks, you notice that whenever you pass Steve's office, he's sitting alone, working at his computer. You have yet to see him with the CEO. If you stop to say hello, he winds up telling you long, rambling stories about his past accomplishments. And while all the other executives are madly preparing for the quarterly board meeting, Steve's still just sitting there. You downgrade Steve's power rating from an 8 to a 5. Rose, on the other hand, seems to show up in many different meetings. She is on a first-name basis with all the executives and speaks frequently with the CEO's assistant. When you ask anyone about a policy or procedure, the answer often begins with, "I think Rose probably knows about that," or, "If you ask Rose, she can tell you what to do." A power upgrade seems to be in order for Rose, maybe from a 3 to a 5. Eventually, you learn that during a recent reorganization, Steve was shuffled into a meaningless job with a fancy title. He is not being discouraged from seeking employment elsewhere. Final power rating for Steve, 2. He gets a couple of points just for having an executive-level position. Rose, you discover, is a 20-year employee who is respected and trusted by everyone. She works with people at all levels, has a broad knowledge of the company, and remains in her current job only because she has no interest in being promoted. Final power rating for Rose, 8. If you are looking for an ally, Rose is the way to go. Steve, it turns out, is just an empty suit. Position, power, and personal power. Both your position and your personal characteristics contribute to your power allotment. Position power, which comes with the job, is automatically available to any occupant of a particular role. Hierarchical authority is the most obvious example. The higher your level on the organization chart, the more decisions you get to make. If you're the senior vice president of international something or other, you can probably order lots of people around. And the higher you go, the more access you have to information and resources. However, position power is not solely related to organizational level. For one thing, every organization has higher status and lower status jobs. In any company that has a product on the market, sales will be a high status function. Physicians will top the pecking order in a medical center, and design engineers will be given more status in an electronics company. Why? Because these are the bet-the-business functions, without which the company cannot succeed. But you don't have to be high level or high status to find sources of power in your job. Many humble positions can provide access to important people, opportunities to develop expertise, or a platform for leverage-building activities. Consider the job of receptionist. Receptionists can't tell anyone what to do, but they talk with many people, leading to the development of valuable relationships. If they put forth the effort, receptionists can use this rather low-level, low-status position to acquire business knowledge and a network of allies. If you're thinking, that's all well and good, but receptionists still don't have any real power, then you're missing the point and confusing power with authority. True, a receptionist has little authority, but she does have access to information and connections. Another source of power, specialized knowledge, is available to those in expert positions, jobs which exist to provide in-depth expertise in a specific area. Greg worked in the tax department, a fairly low-profile location. But by developing extremely detailed knowledge of the tax code, Greg acquired a great deal of leverage. He was known as a veritable tax genius. Management would have felt completely helpless addressing a tax issue without Greg, giving him virtually complete job security. As the company grew and became more global, the tax department expanded, and Greg eventually became a vice president. Certain other positions, because of their organizational location, provide the occupants with a unique platform. One of my clients has company-wide responsibility for training in a healthcare corporation. This broad platform allows her to get involved with a variety of important projects, learn about many aspects of the business, and communicate with people from all levels and functions. She recently used her position power to organize a corporate learning and development council composed of middle managers from different departments. Working with this group will not only make her more effective, but also greatly increase her network of potential allies. The point here is that virtually every job contains some power potential. The challenge is to make the most of it. Unfortunately, some people either fail to recognize their position power or seem to fear using it. Bert was one of those people. His position, senior consulting engineer, was given only to those who had reached the pinnacle of technical excellence, automatically conferring prestige, visibility, and the chance to mentor junior staff. Bert seldom made suggestions to his less experienced colleagues, however, because he feared they might view him as condescending or intrusive. As a result, he missed many opportunities to improve the company's products and to increase his own leverage. Even managers sometimes shy away from using position power.